So in Habakkuk chapter 2, starting at verse 6. Will not all of them taunt him with ridicule and scorn, saying, "Woe to him who piles up stolen goods and makes himself wealthy by extortion. How long must this go on? Will not your creditors suddenly arise? Will they not wake up and make you tremble? Then you will become their prey. Because you have plundered many nations, the peoples who are left will plunder you. For you have shed human blood. You have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. Woe to him who builds his house by unjust gain, setting his nest on high to escape the clutches of ruin. You have plotted the ruin of many peoples, shaming your own house and forfeiting your life. The stones of the wall will cry out, and the beams of the woodwork will echo it. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and establishes a town by injustice. Has not the Lord Almighty determined that the people's labour is only fuel for the fire, that the nations exhaust themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbours, pouring it from the wineskin till they are drunk, so that he can gaze on their naked bodies. You will be filled with shame instead of glory. Now it is your turn. Drink and let your nakedness be exposed. The cup from the Lord's right hand is coming round to you, and disgrace will cover your glory. The violence you have done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and your destruction of animals will terrify you. For you have shed human blood, you have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. Of what value is an idol carved by a craftsman, or an image that teaches lies? For the one who makes it trusts in his own creation. He makes idols that cannot speak. Woe to him who says to wood, "Come to life," or to lifeless stone, "Wake up." Can it give guidance? It is covered with gold and silver. There is no breath in it. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him.
Well, poor old Habakkuk. We left him 2 weeks ago, didn't we? Standing on the walls of Jerusalem, waiting for God's answer. Chapter 2, verse 1. I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. And there he has stood, watching and waiting for the answer to his question. In chapter 1, he'd looked around and seen how utterly sinful Jerusalem was. And he'd asked God, "God, why don't you do something about it?" And maybe he wished he'd never asked, because God's answer was to bring upon Jerusalem the terrifying might of Babylon. The wickedness of Jerusalem would be drowned by the wickedness of Babylon. And that, of course, had set Habakkuk scratching his head. "God, how can you do that? Why is that your answer? How can you reduce us to no more than a fish supper?" Chapter 1, verse 14. You have made people like the fish of the sea, like the sea creatures that have no ruler. The wicked foe pulls all of them up with hooks. He catches them in his net. He gathers them up in his dragnet. And that's where we left Habakkuk, waiting with faith for the Lord's answer. The righteous person living by his faithfulness. There's a promise there, isn't there? That the righteous person shall live. This isn't going to be the end for Habakkuk, but there's a condition as well. He'd have to be patient. Faith looks for what is not seen and waits for something which is yet to come. And so we come to our passage today. God's answer. The Lord answers Habakkuk. And what Habakkuk is given is certainty as to the outcome. He's told of a sure and certain outcome. Habakkuk 2 is written as a taunt song, a song that celebrates the downfall of an enemy. In verse 6 it says, "Will not all of them taunt him with ridicule and scorn?" That's taunting Babylon with ridicule and scorn. If you've spent any amount of time in a football terrace, then you'll know the type of song that we're talking about. Your team is 2-0 up. You enter the 90th minute of the game, and the other team have just lost the ball, and the band begins to play. One brilliantly unimaginative chant goes something like this: "That's why you're going down. That's why you're going down. That's why you're going down. That's why you're going down." As I say, it's not brilliantly imaginative, is it? But it does get the point across. Habakkuk 2 gives us certainty of the outcome, that one day they will stand and taunt their enemies. If you will, it will allow them to say, "That's why you're going down." We're going to look at it under two headings this evening, two headings: the wrong materials and the wrong goals. Firstly, Babylon is sure to go down because they're building with the wrong materials. As we read, I'm sure you spotted there was a structure to this chapter. We get five separate woes. They're a cross between a funeral lament, a warning, and a jeer. My German teacher, after being supplied with a stupid answer, was ever fond of advising his students, "If I had remained silent, I would have remained wise." It was an interesting teaching method, but that's what's going on here. It's using proverbial wisdom to taunt the Babylonians. Here's what you should have known. Verse 6, "Woe, the plunderer will be plundered. Woe to him who piles up stolen goods and makes himself wealthy by extortion. How long must this go on? Will not your creditors suddenly arise? Will they not wake up and make you tremble? Then you will become their prey. Because you have plundered many nations, the people who are left will plunder you. For you have shed human blood. You've destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them." One day there is going to be a reversal. Their roles will be reversed, and that they will receive back precisely the treatment that they dished out to others. The plunderer will be plundered. Their creditors, in verse 7, is really speaking about those that gave them the money in the first place. And by gave, I mean give in the loosest of senses. Their creditors are those who they took their plunder from, by extortion in verse 6, and by bloodshed, and by violent destruction in verse 8. Now, we don't have to stretch too far, do we, to find a modern equivalent of extracting money by extortion. We're not far from betting shops, are we, that always just happen to spring up in the most deprived of neighborhoods, building wealth and greed through extortion. Those that they stole from, though, in Babylon will arise and make the Babylonians tremble. Babylon had sought security by greed, by piling up wealth, but that very greed will be the makings of their downfall as their debtors arise and take them down. They built with the wrong material. Second woe, then. Woe, the builder will be demolished. We're taken next to an eagle's nest, high on a mountain crag, in verse 9. "Woe to him who builds his house with unjust gain, setting his nest on high to escape the clutches of ruin. They tried to build their security by building on the ruins of others. During his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had tried to thicken the walls of Babylon to 136 feet. That's 41 meters wide in places. But in doing so, he's been the architect of his own downfall. The bricks and mortar are the very ones that read out his guilty verdict. Verse 11, the stones of the wall will cry out and the beams of the woodwork will echo it. We were built with blood and injustice, and because of that we will be overturned. They built their security with the wrong material, on the ruin of others and by unjust gain. You may remember the Bangladeshi garment factory that collapsed in 2013. I wonder if we walked through the head offices of businesses today, what tales their shiny walls might tell us. Tales of how they were built at the expense of others. Again, to those who seek security and power. Third woe. Woe to him who builds a city. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and establishes a town with injustice. Has not the Lord Almighty determined that the people's labor is only fuel for the fire, that the nations exhaust themselves for nothing? There's an emptiness to what they were doing. It's as if they're spinning their way around on a hamster wheel, exhausting themselves for nothing. Bloodshed and cruelty can't hold a city together. It's well illustrated by the poem Ozymandias by Percy Shelley. Let me read it. It says, I met a traveller from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in a desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunken, a shattered face lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. On the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty in despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. Cruelty has within it the seeds of its own destruction. It will one day come to nothingness. And fourthly, the shameless will be shamed. Verse 15. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbor, pouring it from the wineskin till they're drunk, so that they can gaze on their naked bodies. You will be filled with shame instead of glory. Now it's your turn. Drink and let your nakedness be exposed. The cup from the Lord's right hand is coming round to you, and disgrace will cover your glory. It's somewhat difficult to tell exactly what's going on here. Is the king of Babylon literally dragging others down into debauchery? Or maybe it's a metaphor for Babylon causing other nations to stagger by her violent conquest. Either way, they sought profit and pleasure through personal exploitation. We're painfully close, aren't we, to the atrocities exposed by the hashtag MeToo movement, or the pornographic industry. I dare say that there's much wine involved there too. But the cup that you made others drink is coming round to you. God will give them a taste of their own medicine. My friend was once a member of a rugby club, and he told me that part of the initiation ceremony was to do a dirty pint. They were forced to drink a potent cocktail of wines and spirits and other less sanitary liquids. The idea being that you had to drink every last drop and then tip the cup upside down over your own head once it was empty. And it usually ended in vomiting, sickness and a very bad hangover. But the cup of stumbling, that the Babylonians forced on other nations will one day come back to them. Their own heads will be pulled back, their mouth will be held open, and it will be their own cocktail that chokes them. But what I want you to see here is the certainty of it, the inevitability of it. It's as if we're watching a child building a sandcastle on a beach. We know that they're building with the wrong materials. We know that they're building in the wrong place, and it will inevitably just wash away. It will all fall apart. But nevertheless, they build on. If you seek to pile up stolen wealth, it will come back to haunt you. If you build on the ruin of others, then watch out. If you seek security in power or in personal exploitation, then woe betide. You are building with the wrong materials, and that's why you're going down. And that's what history teaches us, isn't it? There's no cheating this. Babylon's rise was almost supernatural in its speed, as too was its fall. It came crashing down in a day. Verse 7 had predicted, "Will not your creditors suddenly arise?" And they did. Very soon after its rise, it spectacularly fell to the Medo-Persian Empire, as do all evil empires, eventually come crashing down. I've got a fascinating timeline at home, a history of world empires, all spread out next to each other on a timeline. But the remarkable thing about it is, no matter how large the empire, no matter how vast its scale, they all come to an end. They all collapse. But the lessons of history aren't often heeded, are they? We don't have to look too far to see countries and cultures and companies, even individuals, seeking security in stolen wealth, the ruin of others through bloodshed and exploitation. And here's where the warning hits home. If you build with these materials, it will fall apart. One day, those who you taunted will whisper proverbs in your ear. Here's what you should have known. It's a law written into creation. Proverbs 28:8. Whoever sows injustice reaps calamity, and the rod that they wield in fury will be broken. That was true of Babylon then, and it's true of Babylon now. Babylon in the Bible becomes a byword for godless society and anything that stands in opposition to God, which will just as surely go down. Habakkuk 2 is doing for Israel what Revelation 18 does for us. It assures us that God is not blind to evil. It assures us that God does not approve of injustice. It assures us that God will one day do away with everything that opposes him, and we will rejoice over it with the words from Revelation 18. Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Give back to her as she has given. Pay her back double for what she has done. Pour her a double portion from her own cup. Give her as much torment and grief as she gave glory and luxury to herself. In her heart she boasts, "I sit enthroned as queen. I am not a widow. I will never mourn." Therefore, in one day, her plagues will overtake her, death, mourning, and famine. She will be consumed by fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her. That's why she's going down. But secondly, their fate is sealed not just by the materials that she uses, but by the goal that they strive towards as well. They're building with the wrong materials, and they're building towards the wrong goal. See, did you notice what the Babylonians were after? What spurred their horses on? What gave speed to their feet? Look closely with me. They were seeking after glory. We can see that throughout Habakkuk, can't we? But it comes out most clearly in verse 16. You will be filled with shame instead of glory. The cup from the Lord's right hand is coming round to you, and disgrace will cover your glory. Babylon are building for themselves glory. It's a glory built on the disgrace and shame of others, though. There are two ways, aren't they, of making yourself look bigger. Either you magnify yourself or you shrink others. When they filmed Gandalf and the Hobbits in The Lord of the Rings, they gave the Hobbits really big mugs to make them look smaller, and they gave Gandalf a really small mug to make him look bigger. And like a bully, Babylon had sought to glorify herself by making others look small, by demeaning others, and had strived towards a glory that was unassailable. One inscription engraved in the Babylonian walls says that Nebuchadnezzar, his chief purpose in thickening the walls, was to make for his reign an everlasting name. But if you look at those ruins today, you won't see glory. You'll see lone and level sand stretch far away. But the building language brings to mind somewhere else in the Bible, doesn't it? The building language builds to mind the Tower of Babel. Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly, they say. Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. The same motives that were at play in Babylon are at play in Babel. To build not just a tower, not just a town, but to build a name, an everlasting name. And more than just glory, Babylon is reaching for godhood. That becomes clear in the fifth woe, doesn't it? Down in verses 18 and 19. Of what value is an idol carved by a craftsman, or an image that teaches lies? For the one who makes it, trusts in his own creation. He makes idols that cannot speak. Woe to him who says to wood, come to life, or to lifeless stone, wake up. Can it give guidance? Is it covered with gold and silver? There's no breath in it. See, Babylon has overstepped the mark. She doesn't consider herself a tool in God's hand, but the Creator himself. Verse 18, they attempt to make a god, crafting it from gold and silver and wood and stone. And then they do the god action, don't they? They try and breathe life into lifeless earth. They say to the wood, come to life. They say to lifeless stone, wake up. They try to do what God had done in Genesis, to take lifeless earth and put breath in its nostrils. They're trying to reverse their status as creatures. They're trying to become a creator, to make God in our image rather than him making us in his image, which is an attractive proposition, isn't it? Because it will mean that we're then the ones who are pulling the strings. If I make a God like me, then of course that God will give me what I want, which is at the heart of all idolatry. We cede godhood to something else, not so that they can be in charge, but so that we can. That's why many of the Greek gods were all about things that they wanted. They prayed to Ares, the god of war, to give success in war. They prayed to Demeter, the god of the harvest, to give them a really good harvest. They prayed to Hera, the goddess of marriage, to give them marriage and children. A god of our own making can be twisted and is duty-bound to give us what we want. And that's true of the idols that we make today as well, in our contemporary culture. Money, career, sex, power, a person, a possession. We choose for ourselves gods that we can manipulate to our own will, that will ultimately bow the knee to us and give us what we want. Security, status, pleasure, approval, affirmation, comfort. But notice it's a striving towards the wrong goal. Because God gives us three absolute guarantees. Firstly, he gives us a promise. Babylon's search for complete glory will result in nothing but shame. You will be filled with shame instead of glory. Their labors only fuel for the fire, and they tire themselves out for nothing. And why is that? Well, because one day, verse 14, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. God gives Habakkuk a promise to cling to. One day my glory will flood the earth. That word for glory means weightiness, the heaviness, the very godness of God. His splendor and his majesty will flood the earth just as water spreads from pole to pole. Which means that building a name for yourself is a somewhat pointless exercise. It's like me trying to boast about my running prowess in front of Usain Bolt. It's just not going to work. All the human glories are going to be washed away by the tsunami of God's glory. Habakkuk is given a future promise that puts what Babylon is doing in the present into perspective. It's almost like we're reading a book where we already know the ending. No matter how dark it will get, no matter what twists and turns it will take, no matter how Babylon postures and parades, we can still take heart because we know that it will be all right in the end. And that future promise is even clearer to us, isn't it? Because we know more about the end than Habakkuk did. Revelation 21, verses 1 to 5 say, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them, and he will be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eye. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away.' He who was seated on the throne said, 'I'm making everything new.' Then he said, 'Write these down, for these words are trustworthy and true.'" We can be confident in the present because we know how it ends. We've read the last chapter. We know how it ends. Secondly, he gives us a present reality. See, there's a fundamental flaw in Babylon's creative process, isn't there? In the idols built with human hands. In that they'll never be able to rise above that. In one sense, they have no power at all. It cannot speak. It is literally described as something like a dumb dummy. It can't speak. It's like those Build-A-Bear factories that popped up a while ago. You go in, don't you, and you pick what fur you want. You pick your stuffing, and you come out with a stuffed toy. A stuffed toy that's nothing like a real bear. If you met a real grizzly bear, I think you could tell the difference. The problem with idols and making idols is that they have even less power than the hands that crafted them. But in another sense, they're very powerful indeed, because they have power to deceive the one who made it. It is a teacher of lies. It lulls its creator into a false sense of security. It tells a lie about our security. I'll protect you. I'll defend you. I'll make you happy. I'll bring you glory. Isn't that the law of wealth? Of a career? Of a pension pot? I will protect you. I'll defend you. I'll make you happy. I'll bring you glory. But the problem is that they no more sit on the throne than we do. The present reality is in verse 20. That the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. See, if you asked an ancient Israelite to draw you a map of the world, it would have Israel at the center. And at the center of Israel, you'd have Jerusalem. And at the center of Jerusalem, you'd have the temple. And if you were to go past the temple courts, the temple wall, and the temple curtain, you would find at the center God's throne and God's presence. At the center of the world, there is God, sat on his throne, ruling with absolute justice. And that's a call to Babylon. Babylon, hush. Cease your babble. Be silent. Stop all those arguments, all those arrogant assertions of human power, the efforts at human glory and petty ambition. It is the Lord, it is Yahweh, who sits on the throne, not Nebuchadnezzar, not your idols. It's a call for reverence. The one who is speaking is the Lord of the universe. He is sovereign Lord, active in history, and calls all men and women, all nations and governments, to bow the knee. It's a call to Babylon. But it's also an answer to Habakkuk's complaint as well. The phrase is almost onomatopoeic, like the English word hush. Habakkuk had cried in grief, "How long? Why? Why do you treat us this way?" And God doesn't discourage us from asking those questions. He's always open to hear our prayers and our cries and our questions. But he does demand that we listen to the answer. Habakkuk, hush. I am in my holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before me. The poet Robert Browning once wrote that God is in his heaven and all is well with the world. I'm not sure if he was inspired by this verse, but it has a similar idea. That's what Habakkuk needs to hear. That's what we need to hear. That God is in his holy temple. God is sat on the throne, ruling and reigning. That's the answer that Job was given to human suffering. The answer isn't, "Job, here's why you're suffering." But the answer is, "Job, I'm sat on the throne. I'm still in charge. The situation is not out of my hands. Will you trust me? Will you stay silent before me?" Or if we were to put that in New Testament terms, it is to say, Jesus is risen. He is risen to the right hand of the Father in heaven. He is reigning with absolute surety and justice. That's why we don't give way to fear, even in the face of the uncertainties of life in this world. Amidst pain and suffering, amidst all the attacks on the church and the gospel, verse 20 remains the ultimate reality. Verse 20, the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. Jesus is sat on his throne and is working all things for the good of those who love him. If Habakkuk is to live by faith, he needs to hold on to both of these things. If we're to live by faith, we need to hold on to both of them, both the promise for the future and the present reality, and thirdly, we need to hold on to the gospel pointer. See, the problem is that Babylon is just like Babel, and Babel is just like Jerusalem. God's people are indistinct from the world around them, seeking security in wealth, power, violence, injustice, even in gods of their own making. And perhaps we're not even far from that either. How can we avoid being cast down in utter shame? How can we survive this certain end? Well, notice one last reversal taking place. This time not captor becoming captive or creature becoming a creator, but a greater day of reversal. When the cup of staggering would come round, not to Babylon, and not to Jerusalem, it would pass us by as well. But the cup of staggering would come round to the hands of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus knew what that cup held. A cup of shame, a cup of staggering, a cup of nakedness and exposure, a cup of disgrace, if you will, a dirty pint. And he prayed, "Abba, Father, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." Jesus, knowing what it would cost him to drink it, willingly took that cup, that dirty pint, from the hands of Babylon, from the hands of you and I. Our captain steps in and drinks it down to the last dregs. He turns the cup upside down and places it on his head and cries out, "It is finished. The cup has been drained. There is nothing left for us to drink." And so instead, we're offered a new cup, a cup of forgiveness, a cup of blessing, a cup of life. No matter our past actions, this taunt song need not be sung about us. And that's what we celebrate, isn't it, as we come to communion this evening. The cup of wrath has passed from us, and that's what we're going to celebrate in the words of our next song. My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but wholly lean on Jesus' name. On Christ, the solid rock I stand. All other ground is sinking sand. Let's stand together and sing in response.